Chapter 76. Vital Clues. Edgar Wallace wrote a novel called The Clue of the Twisted Candle, in which an ingenious murderer succeeds in sealing a room by wedging a candle under the heavy latch of the door. As the candle gradually bends in the warmth of the room, the latch, inaccessible from outside, falls into its groove. Wallace was writing in the early days of forensic science, but even so, his stratagem would have given little trouble to most experienced police officers. To begin with, some of the soft candle wax would inevitably have scraped off on the underside of the heavy latch, and the most stupid detective would have worked out the truth within minutes. In real life, most vital clues are altogether less obvious. In the 200 years or so since its beginnings, scientific crime detection has reached a high degree of efficiency. Even so, the kind of brilliant deduction practiced by Sherlock Holmes plays little part in the solution of modern crimes. It's a matter of hard work, patience, and luck. We can see all three of these elements in the classic case of the De Mobb suit, recounted by Superintendent Bob Fabian of the Yard. In the summer of 1946, Police Constable Arthur Collins attempted to detain five men who were trying to enter a building in Warwick. He was so badly beaten and kicked that for a time it was feared he might die. The five men escaped, and the only clue was a small piece of cloth torn from the jacket of one of the men by the constable's wife, who had tried to come to the rescue of her unconscious husband. The Warwick police decided to ask the help of Scotland Yard, and Fabian was put onto the case. The cloth was photographed, and the photographs sent off to tailors all over England. Then it was exhibited in the window of a local newspaper office. An ex-army officer was able to tell Fabian that it was undoubtedly from a De Mobb suit. Fabian plodded to the nearest Ministry of Supply depot in Birmingham. There, a check with a register showed that this pattern had been manufactured by a firm in Wellington in Somerset. The police drove through the night, only to be told at the factory that this cloth had been enough for no less than 5,000 suits. Moreover, soldiers often sold them to wide boys at the gates of the camp. However, they were able to give Fabian the address of two factories in Birmingham and one in Glasgow who had bought the cloth. Fabian drove back to Birmingham. Neither of the two factories had started using their consignment yet. Fabian went on to Glasgow, and there a supervisor looked at the torn fragment and was able to tell from the stitching the name of the man who had made it into a suit. "Stitching is as distinct as handwriting," he said. And finally, the long shot paid off. The workman looked at the cloth and was able to recall that the suit was made for an exceptionally tall and broad man. It had had to be specially made, and so he remembered it. The ordnance depot at Branston, near Burton-on-Trent, was able to give Fabian the name of the ex-soldier for whose De Mobb they had ordered the suit, and the police found him at the Birmingham address to which the suit had been posted. When the police constable's wife identified him as her husband's assailant, the big Irishman, 6 feet 2.5 inches tall, broke down and admitted his part in the robbery. He received 4 years penal servitude. This same quality of incredible patience can be found in a case that certainly ranks among the epics of classic detection. It took place in 1869. During the January of that year, a restaurant owner from the Rue Princesse in Paris noticed that the water from the well tasted foul. He investigated and found a parcel floating in the water. When it was opened, it proved to contain the lower half of a human leg. The horrified restaurateurs sent for the police, and a young detective named Gustave Massé was placed in charge of the case. He looked down the well and found another parcel. In it was another leg, encased in a stocking. Doctors told Massé the legs were almost certainly a woman's. Acting on this assumption, Massé obtained the files of 122 missing women and set about tracing them. It took him months, and finally there were only three left. Shortly after Massé had finally succeeded in tracing these remaining three, the doctors admitted that they could have been wrong. The legs were womanish, but could have belonged to a man. Massé heaved a sigh and started all over again. He had two leads. On December the 22nd of the previous year, a policeman had met a man wandering along the Rue de Seine carrying a hamper. Because of the late hour, he asked the man what was in it, and the man said that he had just arrived in Paris from the country by train. Unable to find a cab, he had been forced to walk with his hamper of country products. He looked so honest that the policeman let him go, but his description, short, round-faced, with a black moustache, led Massey to suspect that this was the same man who had been seen a few days earlier throwing lumps of meat into the River Seine. Someone asked him what he was doing, and he said that he was baiting the river because he intended to fish the next day. Since then, large gobbets of meat had been fished out of the river, too big for the average fish to swallow. The stitches on the parcel in which the first leg had been sewn had a professional look about them. Moreover, why had the murderer chosen the restaurant to dump the leg? It might, of course, be a dissatisfied customer who wanted to spoil the trade, or it might be someone who had lived in the upstairs part of the house at the time. He asked the concierge if there was a tailor in the house. No. Had there ever been one? No. But there had been a tailoress. That sounded a long shot, but Massey had no other lead. He interviewed the girl, who told him that she often did jobs for other tailors. Did any of them ever visit her at the house? Many of them did, she said. One in particular, Monsieur Voisbeau, who was very kind and helpful. He often fetched water up from the well for her. Voisbeau was a tailor, and he knew the well. Massey asked the girl if this Voisbeau had had any special friends. There was one old man, she said, a Monsieur Baudas. She didn't know where he lived, but he had an aunt who lived in the Rue de Nesle. Massey didn't know the aunt's exact address, but compared to tracing 100 or so missing women, it was child's play to locate her, and Madame Baudas was able to tell Massey that her nephew lived in the Rue Dauphin. He was a retired craftsman who had been a tapestry manufacturer. Oddly enough, he hadn't been seen for some weeks now, but that wasn't unlike him. His habits were strange. The concierge at old Baudas's apartment startled Massey by telling him Baudas was at home. She had seen the light in his flat the night before, but he wouldn't answer the door. He was an eccentric. Massey felt he had now discovered the identity of the victim. His guess was confirmed when Madame Baudas identified the stocking, made of white cotton, with a man's sock sewn on the bottom, as belonging to her nephew. She also thought the legs were his. As to the mystery man, Pierre Voisbeau, he was a police spy, a man who pretended to be a rabid anarchist and attended left-wing meetings only to make reports to the police. Massey broke into Baudas's apartment. Everything looked neat, and an 8-day clock was still ticking. Massey decided to have the place watched, and he borrowed a couple of men from the secret police. This proved to be a mistake. They knew Voisbeau as a colleague, and when they saw him entering the building, they accosted him and asked him why they were supposed to be watching him. Massey's quarry was alerted. But Massey already had much valuable evidence. Baudas's strongbox was empty, but in the back of a watch, Massey found a piece of paper with numbers of various securities written on it. Probing Voisbeau's background, Massey discovered that, until a few months ago, he had lived in fairly cheap lodgings and had seemed to be poor. Then he had married and moved elsewhere, paying his rent with a 500-franc share that could be cashed by anyone. Massey hastened to the money changer. He had kept the counterfoil of the share, the number tallied with the one in the watch. Massey decided it was time to interview Voisbeau. And now began the cat-and-mouse game. Voisbeau was a plump and cheerful young man of 30, and he appeared to be a man of resourcefulness and character. Treating Massey as a friend, since they both worked for the police, he admitted that he had been worried about Baudas's non-appearance. He suspected that he might have been killed, in which case the murderer was an alcoholic butcher named Riffer, a petty crook who had almost certainly been aided by 3 criminal acquaintances whom Voisbeau also helpfully pointed out. When Massey checked, he discovered that 2 of the 3 had perfect alibis. They had been in jail throughout December. And not long after, the alcoholic butcher had a fit of DTs and was taken to an asylum. Massey decided he had to arrest Voisbeau. It proved to be a wise decision, for Voisbeau had a ticket to Havre in his wallet, and other indications showed that he intended to embark for America. Voisbeau seemed surprised and offended. What had he done that Massey should suspect him? They both knew there was no evidence. This, unfortunately, was true. Massey went to talk to Voisbeau's wife, a quiet girl who obviously knew little of her husband's character and still less of his activities. Massey learned from her that she had brought her husband a dowry of 15,000 francs, that's about £600. Voisbeau had gained the consent of her parents by telling them that he had 10,000 francs in securities. In fact, he had produced them before the wedding, but where were they now? The strongbox was empty. Massey searched the house, and finally, in the cellar, he found Baudas's securities. They had been soldered into a tin box and suspended in a cask of wine. But even that did not prove Wabo was a murderer. Massey now returned to Wabo's old flat. A young couple had moved in, but they showed Massey precisely where the table had been when they first arrived. Massey was convinced that this was where Baudas had been killed. The cleaning woman had told him that Wabo was notoriously untidy, and yet on the morning of December the 17th, the day after Baudas was last seen alive, his room had been polished and scrubbed. If Baudas had been killed at the table, then he had probably also been dismembered there, and his blood must have run onto the floor. This was perfectly clean, but it sloped a little towards the bed. Massey staged his final scene with all the dramatic flair of a fictional detective. Wabo was taken to his old room in Rue Mazarin. He seemed calm and indifferent. Massey took a jug of water, poised it over the spot where the table used to stand, and poured it. The water flowed slowly across the floor and formed a pool under the bed. Wabo suddenly became restive. Massey sent for a mason and ordered him to take up the floor tiles under the bed. The dark undersides were found to be coated with dried blood. Suddenly, Wabo's nerve broke, and he made his confession. He had been tired of being a scoundrel, a petty crook, he said. He decided he wanted to settle down as a married man. He was in love with a gentle Mademoiselle Raimonde, but it was necessary to impress her parents that he also had money. He begged his friend Baudas to lend it to him. Baudas refused. Wabo decided he had to die. He invited him to his room for tea one day after they had dined together. Wabo moved casually behind him, picked up a flat iron and struck Baudas on the head. Later, he dismembered the body and distributed the pieces around Paris, mostly in the river. After meeting the policeman, who wanted to look into his basket, which contained bones and flesh, he decided to get rid of the legs by dumping them in a nearby well. Wabo was guillotined for the murder of Désiré Baudas. But for one tiny mistake, sewing the leg into a piece of calico, he would have avoided suspicion. And what's more, if he had kept his wits about him, he could have avoided detection even when the underside of the tiles showed the traces of blood. He only had to deny that he knew where it came from, or declare that it was animal blood from a joint. In 1869, there was still no way of testing blood to determine whether it came from a man or an animal. The story of how blood analysis was perfected is one of the great epics of scientific detection. Scientists like Pasteur and Koch had discovered that if a human body is injected with dead germs, the blood will develop a resistance to living forms of the same germs. Thus, immunization was discovered. 20 years later, in the 1890s, a German, von Behring, discovered that if a horse is injected with dead diphtheria germs, the serum from its blood, that is, the clear liquid that separates out when blood is allowed to stand, will actually help children who are suffering from diphtheria to recover. The serum develops fighting properties. Around the turn of the century, a chemist named Paul Uhlenhut discovered that this same serum has even more remarkable properties. If a rabbit is injected with human blood, its blood serum develops a resistance to human blood. And if the serum is placed in a test tube and the tiniest drop of human blood is introduced into it, it turns cloudy. It will not react at all to animal blood. In 1901, shortly after Uhlenhut had made his discovery, a travelling carpenter named Ludwig Tesnau was arrested on the Baltic island of Rügen, suspected of a particularly atrocious murder. Two small boys had been found in the woods, hacked and torn to pieces, and scattered over a wide area. 3 years earlier, Tesnau had been arrested on suspicion of killing two schoolgirls near the village of Lechtingen, near Osnabrück. He had protested that certain stains on his clothes were of wood stain, not blood, and the police had had to release him for lack of evidence. Now he was questioned about a recently washed suit that showed slight traces of blood. Tesnau said that some of the almost obliterated stains were cattle blood and that the others were wood stain. When the examining magistrate received the information from Osnabrück, he realised he was dealing with a man possessed of some insane desire to batter living creatures and to tear them to pieces. A month before the two boys had been murdered, someone had attacked 7 sheep in a field, cut them open and scattered the entrails all over the field. The shepherd had seen the man running away. He now identified Tesnau as the sheep butcher. But Tesnau denied everything. Fortunately, the prosecutor had kept abreast of new developments in legal medicine and had heard about Ullenhut's discovery. He sent Ullenhut the blood-stained clothing and also the stone that had been used to batter the children. Ullenhut discovered dozens of small stains in salt water and tested all of them. He found 22 human blood stains and half a dozen stains of sheep's blood. His evidence convicted Tesnau, who was sentenced to death. Not only would the serum distinguish human blood from animal blood, it would also distinguish different types of human blood, the groups A, B, O and AB. This discovery should have provided sufficient evidence to hang a suspect in Gladbeck in Germany in 1928, but a jury of sceptical burghers declined to convict on purely scientific evidence. The accused was 20-year-old Karl Hussmann, a dominant and violent student. In the early hours of March the 23rd, 1928, a youth named Helmut Dobe had been found dying in the street. His throat had been cut and his genitals slashed off. The police soon discovered that Dobe's closest friend was his fellow student, Hussmann. And when they went to Hussmann's house, they discovered that his shoes had recently been washed and showed traces of blood. His clothes were also bloodstained. Hussmann had completely dominated Dobe, and the two had been lovers. But recently, Dobe had realised that he preferred girls and had tried to break away. At first, Hussmann claimed that the blood was that of a cat that he had killed, but Ullenhut's test quickly revealed that it was human blood. Hussmann then changed his story and said that he had had a nosebleed. The forensic laboratory at Bonn demonstrated that this was also impossible, for the blood on his shoes was type A, Dobe's group, while Hussmann was type O. The feeling of the court was that, while they were not convinced of Hussmann's innocence, they were by no means happy about convicting him on what to them amounted to purely circumstantial evidence, and so Hussmann was acquitted. But the case drew wide attention to the use of testing for blood groups in criminal cases. Since that time, many criminals have been hanged on the evidence of a dried blood spot on a wooden floor. On humane grounds, perhaps the jury was right to disregard circumstantial evidence, for there's also the danger of hanging an innocent man. The case of Burton Abbott provides a thought-provoking illustration. Abbott was known to his neighbours in Alameda, California, as a quiet, rather intellectual man. He had never been known to be violent and had no police record. On July the 15th, 1955, Abbott's wife was looking through old clothes in the basement when she found a wallet. It contained the identification card of 14-year-old Stephanie Bryan, some photographs, and an unfinished letter dated April the 28th, 1955. That had been the day when Stephanie had disappeared after coming out of school in Berkeley. She had never been seen since. Georgia Abbott took the wallet upstairs and asked her husband how it had got there. He seemed as puzzled as she was, and they called the police. The next day, the police dug up Abbott's basement and found Stephanie's school books and her bra. Abbott pointed out that his garage had recently been used as a polling place and that dozens of people had been in and out. However, a newsman went up to Abbott's summer cabin on Trinity Mountain with two dogs. The dogs led him to a shallow grave. Stephanie Bryan's body was found in it. She had been strangled with her own panties, and the circumstances pointed to sexual assault. Abbott was arrested and tried. He insisted that he knew nothing whatever about Stephanie or about her clothes, and there was certainly no definite evidence to connect him with her disappearance. But the jury convicted him. There were several stays of execution. The last one came just after 11:15 a.m. on March the 14th, 1957. But it arrived a few minutes too late. The cyanide gas pellets had been dropped under the execution chair at 11:15 precisely. Abbott persisted in denying his guilt to the end, although he is said to have told a doctor, "I can't admit it. Think of what it would do to my mother." All the evidence suggests that Abbott was the killer of Stephanie Bryan, yet there is an element of doubt. For example, he could have been framed by her real killer. The brilliant triumphs of scientific crime detection should never blind us to the fact that the word clue means an indication, and that, forensically, there is a vital difference between an indication and a final proof.